Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome back to season three of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're talking to these archive addicts about what kinds of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
We'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Eve and I are presently enjoying occupancy in what we call Melbourne today, that is, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded. We are thrilled to be speaking to award-winning journalist, author and television presenter Jess Hill. Jess Hill is an investigative journalist who has been writing and researching about domestic abuse since 2014. Before that, she was a producer for ABC Radio, a Middle East correspondent for the Global Mail, and an investigative journalist for ABC's Background Briefing. She was listed in Foreign Policy's Top 100 Women to Follow on Twitter, and also as one of the 30 most influential people under 30 by Cosmopolitan magazine. Her reporting has won two Walkley Awards, an Amnesty International Award, and three Our Watch Awards. Jess's book, See What You Made Me Do, was released in June 2019 and has since become a global phenomenon, winning multiple literary awards, including the 2020 Stella Prize, and shortlisted for many others, including the Human Rights Commission's Media Award, and spawning revised UK and US editions, as well as a television documentary series which first aired on Australian television on the SBS network in May 2021. See What You Made Me Do has been described by journalist Rick Morton as the most important book of the last decade on one of the most critical issues in our time. Congratulations, Jess, and welcome to Archives Anonymous.
Thanks, Claire, and hello, Eve. We made it.
We made it. Just going to tell you listeners, this is the fifth time we've tried to get Jess on Archive Fever, and it has not been Jess's fault that it's taken us so many times. There have been multiple interventions, mostly from the COVID gremlins who have in one way or another stymied our efforts, but we're here now and we're just thrilled to have you. Jess, let's dive right on in. You were trained as an investigative journalist. When did you first get bitten by the research bug?
Well, so I'm going to pick you up on just one word there, and that is trained. So I actually wasn't trained. I, full disclosure, never went to uni. Well, no, that's not quite true. I did go to uni for about 2 weeks. So it was very short-lived. So yes, didn't get trained. But when I got bitten by the research bug was when I was very young. So this program is so perfect for me because I am totally a history nerd, totally a research nerd, such that when I used to truant from school, which I did quite often, I truanted because I wanted to do my own research at home because I didn't like the syllabus at school. And so I actually bought my own history books and did my own assignments.
Yeah, no, that is peak nerd. You've out-nerded us.
Yeah, not even we did that.
Yeah, and I lived right by the beach. Like, I mean, everyone else was truanting to go surfing and I didn't even go near the beach on my days off, partly because I knew that's where you'd get caught, but also because I was too busy reading Albert Speer on Hitler, or like I just didn't feel like the syllabus at school was open enough in its thinking. It was so didactic and various things just were taboo. You know, and so I just felt that was a waste of my time.
So where did you go? Did you go to the library?
I can't remember where. I had this great like history book with all these exercises in the back. I think I got it from a garage sale. I wasn't a library kid. I'm not a joiner. So I'm classic kind of autodidact in the sense that I'm very self-driven, but I don't even like join institutions to research. And I hadn't thought about that until recently when someone was saying that they weren't a joiner. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's me. I'm not a joiner.
I see. So I was imagining like Roald Dahl's Matilda then. heading off to the library to actually expand your mind and get your fill, but not even the library.
Not even the library. Well, my parents, and I lived with my grandmother as well from when I was about 8, and books were everywhere. So I never felt like I had to go to the library, I guess. I'm sure I would have found a wider diversity of books, but my nonna, she was married to a man who was very much into philosophy, an old Labour man. He actually helped start the Copyright Council in Australia. So there was no lack, you know, of resource material.
Okay, so no library and no training at school, but clearly a deep love of research. Can you tell us what archive fever feels like for you? What is your response when you're actually in the grip of it?
Yeah, it's like going down a rabbit hole, which I'm sure is how it feels for most people. But because I didn't have access to the academy or to the institutions, and I hope I don't sort of, you know, have a warrant put out on me for saying this in public, but, you know, archive fever to me looked like going onto Sci-Hub and unlocking journal articles like one after the other. And it was like going into a candy store. It's like, I can have anything, you know, until I discovered Sci-Hub, which basically is, well, how would you describe it? It's a Russian site that unlocks journal articles that are otherwise locked to everyone aside from people who are at an institution or, yeah, has access to journal articles. And so you find the journal article you're looking for, put it into Sci-Hub, and it's open. And for me, honestly, it's the only way I was able to write this book, because I just wouldn't have had access to that material otherwise. I would find something that I really wanted to look up, and then it'd be going to the references and just going back through that author's process and really double checking, like, how had they come to that conclusion? Are they only looking at particular reference material that aligns with a particular ideological take, or are they open-minded about this question? And in the field of domestic violence research, that's really pertinent, because there's very particular schools of thought that are often kind of at war with each other. And so you can have a paper that purports to look at why men are abusive or the role of alcohol, and you have to really ascertain from the start, do you belong to a particular ideological school of thought, or are you coming at this from a more open-ended perspective? And then you have to read with that in mind.
So we're getting closer to your latest book, See What You Made Me Do. Jess, all good research starts with a question, not a proposition, and all the best research starts with an against-the-grain question. In seeking to understand the horrifying statistic that one in four women has experienced violence from a man she was intimate with, your starting point was this. Too often we ask the wrong question, why didn't she leave? We should be asking, why did he do it? How did you asking the right question change the nature of your research?
Well, you'd both know that the question is everything. That's where you start from. It defines the limits and parameters of what you're going to find. I say that in the book, not as someone who's, you know, coming down from the mountain holding stone tablets. It's because I was asking the wrong questions to begin with. And when I say wrong questions, what I mean is, not so much that you should never ask why a woman didn't leave, because I think there are really important ways to answer that question. And it still does confound a lot of people. And if they're confounded by it, they should ask the question. The problem is that it's the first question that we ask, and it's often the end of the question. And so once there's an answer to that, there's rarely a follow-up question as to why didn't he do it? Or there wasn't when I was first writing this book. You know, perpetrators were so invisibilized in the conversation about domestic abuse. When I started, I think I became obsessed with this subject because I realized all the bad questions I was asking, all the questions I wasn't asking. So when I started asking, why does he do it? It's an emotional subject to interrogate. You know, for about a year, I reckon I felt very angry towards perpetrators. I felt a type of loyalty towards victim survivors, you know, both adults and kids. And it was very difficult for me to ask that question in a truly open way, to really want to know the answer in a way that acknowledges the three-dimensionality of people who use abuse and approaches them as humans with the right to dignity. that was like a really big process for me, working through my own rage and that first year really getting across pretty much like the history of patriarchy. So, which was eye-opening for me in so many ways. Being with my psychotherapist husband was very helpful because he was seeing some of these guys and he was really just trying to help me work past my emotional responses to a place where I could comprehend them more objectively. And as I started to get this more objective viewpoint on particularly men who use violence or oppression, it really started to bug me the standard answer that we were using for this question, which was that perpetrators, they do this for power and control. They're driven chiefly by misogyny and disrespect for women, and they're protected by male privilege. So that was the line from almost everyone in the sector through to our police chiefs and even former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. So this was a very neat explanation for what is a chaotic phenomenon that has lines around it but is chaotically human. It began to annoy me, and what I was hearing in our dominant discourse on domestic abuse was two seemingly opposite positions. So we would hear that, you know, perpetrators were often otherwise normal guys in one breath, well-liked, loved by other people, and that's why they're hard to detect. And then in the next, their motivations would be shrunk to this black and white need for power and control. As if, you know, in this complex world of emotion and intimacy, there's nothing more to say about what would turn an otherwise regular guy into an abusive tyrant and someone really capable of sometimes sadistic cruelty. When I started to really interrogate the emotional worlds of these men and to really approach these men as people, I discovered that there was a lot to these questions that I hadn't asked yet. One of them was to look at another stock explanation for men's violence, and that was the one given by men's rights groups, and that was that men become violent because they're victimized by women, by society, that they're truly the oppressed ones, and when they lash out, they're acting in self-defense. You know, those are the sorts of explanations that we instinctively just want to rubbish, to call minimizing, denying, etc. And it is all those things. But moralizing doesn't help you get to the nub of an issue. And scoffing at these perspectives may feel satisfying, but it wasn't helping me understand why do so many men seem to hold these beliefs and really believe what they're saying. So I began to excavate this, you know, why do perpetrators resonate with this position? And as I started to not only talk to men who'd used violence or oppression in their relationships, but also started to read the research, not just from Australia, which was really critical, but outside, especially some of the research coming out of Scandinavian countries, some coming out of the United States, to look at if perpetrators resonate so closely with this position, what does it tell us about their mindset? And it tells us that they do commonly see themselves as victims. And so seeing the world through their eyes led me to much deeper interrogations of the destructive force of male shame and how that can show up as a type of humiliated fury, which ended up becoming one of the most important and influential chapters in the book. So I think that when you're trying to research something, especially something as contested as why do men commit domestic violence, it's really important to interrogate all your own preconceptions and biases, to combine traditional research, looking at papers, etc., with that real field research, making sure you're testing the presumptions made in these papers or the conclusions with actual people who've used violence and oppression and listening to them, not just writing off what they say as some kind of excuse. Because everything's an excuse, but those excuses are coming from somewhere and they're covering for something. That's, I guess, just a small part of what I was doing to try to flip my frame on this issue. And the rabbit hole that opened up was gigantic. And it took me down lots of different kind of corollary tracks, not just in the domestic abuse field, but in, you know, prison psychiatry, looking at male violence more generally and how shame was associated with that. It was very difficult to stay in these men's minds. But it's really, I think, what makes the book relatable to men is that it speaks to guys from the place they feel.
Jess, as you've outlined for us, you know, perpetrators are often made invisible in discourse on domestic violence. But as your book shows, another thing that's often hidden or invisible is the abuse itself. You know, you write at one point, quote, "the abuser's most skillful trick is to make his abuse invisible." And so that made me really interested in how you go about researching something that is concealed, that is often hidden in plain sight. Could you talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah. Lots of conversations with people who've been subjected to coercive control, people who were just outside of it to get a sense of what it's like to still lack that language to describe what's happened to you, then people who'd been outside of it for 10 plus years, people who were now magistrates, you know, who were victim survivors, just every possible angle on this to try to understand how it made itself invisible, where it started to show up for people. And I guess when I started to see how coercive control didn't just operate in the domestic abuse context, but in various other ones, and where I first read about that was pretty sure in Judith Herman's Trauma and Recovery. That's a really famous book from the 90s, talking about the various ways in which people seek to oppress individuals or groups, but particularly around sexual abuse, domestic violence. And there were some lines in Herman's book about how this had first been identified in prisoner of war situations in North Korea. She didn't go into great detail about it, but immediately when I saw that, I was like, that is fascinating. Like, how would that take us out of this contested space, an emotionally charged space of domestic violence, to something that's a corollary, but something we can look at with greater perspective? So the experience of soldiers. When I went back to find out, well, who did first illustrate what coercive control was, and found out that it was this US Air Force sociologist, Albert Biederman, and went back through his testimony to Congress, talking about how it had made itself invisible to the soldiers who had been trained to resist torture in these camps and to resist interrogation techniques. That's where I was then able to take that framework and apply it to my conversations with victim survivors. I was able to start to see coercive control as a particular form of behaviour that affects anybody, depending on how it's used and what context it's used in. That there was not a particular vulnerability in an individual that would make them more susceptible to coercive control, that it is as a framework. It's sort of like a virus in its ability to take over an individual. So I guess always flipping perspective, trying to zoom out and find other ways to look in. That's what I was always trying to do, to be able to flip my own frame, because there's so much politics, so much history of victim blaming, of misogyny, a lot of that we've all internalized. I've internalized. So if I was only going to look at it through the frame of domestic abuse, I was going to still miss stuff. You know, my internalized misogyny, I had to unpack every single day. I had to unpack my own victim blaming. So that was really helpful. And it also helped me find different sources on coercive control. You know, like if you can start looking up, like, how does it apply in cults? How do you start to answer questions of why don't cult members leave? What are they being subjected to? And what are the similarities? What are the differences? This is why it took a very long time to write this book, because it's really the only way, I think, to free us from our locked-in perspectives about this issue.
Jess, as you've said, it took you a long time to do this, 4 years, and that's not 4 years of sitting in libraries and conventional colonial paper archives. That's 4 years of sitting in people's lounge rooms and at their kitchen tables and listening to their stories of being abused or being abusers. A couple of questions from that. One, just on a nuts and bolts level, how did you find your interview subjects and how much time did you spend with them? And secondly, how did you cope with the enormity of that face-to-face lounge room research process? Like, how did you sustain yourself over the long haul?
That's a good question. insane determination is mostly how I sustain myself. Really amazing support from both my partner emotionally and intellectually in co-writing and editing, and our extended family. But in terms of being in people's lounge rooms and in their lives, I really approached this like a collaboration with each source. So it wasn't a matter of just going and doing the interview and collecting that interview and then working with that material. Those people became part of my life a lot of the time, to varying extents, especially those who were going through family court. You know, I would go and attend their hearings. I would go with them when they attended other people's hearings. I'd get phone calls from them, you know, late at night when something big had broken in their case. You know, it was very much an involved process that never really switched off. So in terms of how did I sustain myself, I think what saved me from going down the plug hole was having a baby, largely, which sounds counterintuitive. It meant that I had to, when my delightful little girl would wake up, I would have to jump out of where I was at and be with her. And it was also utterly transcendent in landing me in this love space. Otherwise, I would have just put everything I had into that process. And as it was, I was putting everything I had while she was asleep or in the care of someone else. It's not a process I could ever repeat in my life ever again. I would never recommend this to anyone, but I think that sometimes writers and artists sort of need to go a bit insane in their projects. It doesn't make it the right way to go about it, but sometimes it feels like the only way to go about it. And I know that I denied myself pleasures and things that would make me feel good. I isolated myself. I basically created a microcosm of just a part of what victim survivors experience when they're in situations of coercive control, to try to get closer to that feeling.
So can you ever walk away from the human archive? Is there a point at which, you know, we can, or other historians say, box away the materials they've been used and file them over there? It seems to me that, you know, you have a vested human responsibility towards the people that you've engaged in this. Can you walk away from a human archive?
There are relationships that do their dash, you know, and so there's certainly people who I've interviewed and been very close to over a period of time where we've had our time together and we'll communicate every now and then. Others have continued since the beginning. I think in terms of the human archive, I, at a meta level, have found it very difficult and, in fact, for me, disingenuous to walk away from the people that I interviewed for the book and the claims or the things I called for in the book, which has created a tricky situation where I've crossed over the barrier of, like, journalist and author into advocate. I can't unsee what I've seen, and feeling like you've got the ears of, you know, powerful people in this country, or just the ears of the public, there's a momentum there that I feel like I can't just drop and say, oh, well, look, I wrote this book, so, you know, the record is there and that's all I've got to say on it. I just can't leave it like that. So when I said in one chapter, and I thought about this for a very long time, whether to say it so definitively, that it was time we criminalized coercive control, I didn't write that sentence with the idea that I would then go on to advocate for that for, like, you know, 2 years. I didn't think it was even going to be a conversation in Australia, to be honest. It was just one of those big ticket items that I could imagine perhaps rising to the surface in the next decade or so. But when you write things like that, I just don't think you can back away from it, especially if in writing that and if in centering that you've played a part in bringing that to the surface and people want to talk to you about it. Like, if a politician wants to talk to me about coercive control and whether they should criminalize, do I say no? And if you say yes, you're an advocate. So the human archive, there are individuals that I'm still in touch with, but on a meta level, it's everyone that I wrote about and everyone I wrote this book for that I continue to stay engaged on this issue for.
Speaking of the momentum around the book, obviously this year it's been turned into a 3-part documentary series on SBS, which has really kind of brought a lot of your ideas, I think, to a much bigger audience and sparked a national conversation around coercive control. Could you tell us about the process of translating a textual document into the visual medium? Like, did you need to really rethink the story you're going to tell? Did you need to do different types of research?
It was so amazing working with Northern Pictures and Tosca Luby, Olivia Rousset, and everyone who worked on that program, because they'd actually been working on a program for SBS for about a year before they contacted me. Then the book came out and they thought, oh, this woman's already done all the work. So they approached me to present it and to sort of do an adaptation of the book. But essentially we were just looking at adapting the themes. There's only a couple of things from the book that reappear in the series. The Mullaly story was a really important one because I felt like that story needed the television treatment to really get it into people's minds. The book had not managed to make it, you know, a well-known story as it should be. And women's police stations, a few things like that, a few innovations. But otherwise, it was pretty much all original material. And what was amazing is that particularly Olivia Rousset and Tosca Luby, they went off and did that story producing. So I was a consultant suggesting various stories, people who I'd come into contact with since writing the book. I co-wrote the script, etc. But a lot of it was not me, which was freaking amazing. And what was also so impressive is that they really took the themes in the book and the whole concept of coercive control, how it operates interpersonally and systemically, and they brought that to life in a way that I would not have been able to do. Like, it's funny hearing you introduce me as a TV presenter. That's the first time I've ever heard that. Television's not my bag. So having them go off and do that in consultation with me, but pretty much independently, just meant that it was living a whole new life separate to me. And that's essentially what we want to do, right? Like, once you've really laid out a framework for understanding an issue, you then want other people to take that away and develop it further into places that you might not have thought to do that. There's a theatre director who's just got the rights to a theatre adaptation of the book. I'll have pretty much nothing to do with that. And that's fabulous because I still have limitations on how far I can develop this material because I come from my place as a white, lower middle class woman who has her own life history, who's going to continually come from that position of analysis. And so having other people come at it from their own positions in society is just going to develop it so much further. And I don't have to be the person continually prosecuting this. I hope someone comes along, and there are already plenty of people prosecuting this, I'm not pretending like I'm the only one, but I hope someone else outside of the sector comes along, makes this their reason for being, and takes it way further than I was ever able to.
Jess, we'd like to take this interview much further than we already have, but unfortunately we are limited by time as well. We'd like to ask you one final question that we ask all of our guests here in Archives Anonymous, because it is a safe space. We ask everybody whether they would like to share with us a dirty little archive secret that they might have kept.
Oh, goodness. I probably have dissociated from any of the real archive secrets. I mean, I did totally let go of an archive secret right at the beginning without even having to be prompted, which is that I stole pretty much everything.
through Sci-Hub, yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny, they have to keep on changing their website because they get taken down so often, so I'm constantly keeping an eye on where the new Sci-Hub is.
I see, I feel like such a naive. I've never even heard of it.
Well, no, I think it's an important point because it shows how the gatekeeping of academic research behind paywalls, which means that only people associated with academic institutions can access it. If something like Sci-Hub didn't exist, people like Jess wouldn't have been able to write these kind of books, which is a huge loss. So It kind of links to a broader conversation about why we need to get rid of academic paywalls and make academic research open access to all.
100%. Like, I mean, I really am not overstating it to say I could not have written the book without Sci-Hub. I would have written a book, but I was reading on average like 4 or 5 papers a day. Like, I was just eating them for breakfast. It was so obsessive. Big part of the background of this book was to understand where everybody was coming from a political and ideological perspective. And so I felt I needed to read not only what was available in Australia, but internationally, because actually the analysis from somewhere like Sweden is so, so different from the analysis of, you know, somewhere like Canada, especially from an Indigenous perspective. There is not just one view on this. And when you only look at the kind of material that is openly accessible in Australia through organisations like ANROADS, etc., you're getting quite a particular filter. I think that the scope of it and the scale of the book was absolutely facilitated by the widespread theft of journal articles that I committed.
And there you have it, folks. Jess Hill's dirty little archive secret is that she eats stolen academic journal articles for breakfast.
With a bit of muesli scattered on top.
That's right. Yeah, I hope I have some kind of immunity deal anyway.
Jess, thanks so much for coming along today. We've enjoyed this interview so much. To learn more about Jess's work, you can check out her website, jesshill.net. See What You Made Me Do is published in Australia by Black Ink. We've also put up a bunch of links on the Archive Fever Pod website to complement this episode, including the numbers you can call if this conversation has raised any concerns for you. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of Season 1 and Season 2 of Archive Fever via our website, archivefeverpod.com, and you can see the television version of See What You Made Me Do on SBS Online.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright. And you can follow Jess on Twitter at Jess Radio.
Coming up on the next episode.
Archival interventions for me can be dangerous. People can get offended. I can get offended. I might change my mind about things. People change their mind. They're slippery things.